You're listening to Raising Anchor, the Rhode Island FC podcast, now part of the Blazing Musket family. We're glad you're here. Hello and welcome to Raising Anchor, your podcast and source for all things Rhode Island FC. I'm your host, Matt Entrekin, coming to you this Thursday, February 13th. The USL dropped a bombshell right into the heart of the soccer pyramid, and it's also been a busy week for RIFC, as they've had multiple signings and goals galore during this preseason time down at IMG Academy. Is the roster complete, or is coach always tinkering and always adding? We're going to go over all of the results from the IMG Academy series and then get you ready for the remainder of the preseason around the Hartford game and then, of course, the trip coming up to Bermuda. As a reminder, it's just 30 days until the beginning of the season. And to go over all of this, I mean, this may be the longest podcast in podcast history, but to do it all, the one and only Jason Carey. Jason, do you have a sleeping bag? Are you ready to never leave this room ever again?
Who needs to sleep? Honestly, it's funny because I think that, you know, like, oh, what are we going to talk about? Just a little bit of things here and there. We'll go for about an hour and call it a night. And then the USL is like, hey, guys, check this out. And then, yeah, we could do a whole pod on just their news.
If people only knew, and I know we have some of the content creators. We have Ryan Healy from Tide Talk in here. Nate Holloway, Anchors Up. Taras, good evening to you as well. And, of course, Owen, he just came from the USL show. We just came from the USL show, jumping right in here, and now he's here with us at Raising Anchor. I will say, you're right. You know, sometimes we really have to pull teeth to come up with the content, especially in the off season and the preseason, right? You're like, oh, we're going to talk about a vendor that may, or we're going to talk about Chick-fil-A and the ramifications of them when they have to be here on a Sunday, right? So sometimes it's famine, sometimes it's feast. Tonight, you look at the page count on these show notes and it's
like Thanksgiving.
We're going to need some podcast leftovers. Before we get into this, I don't know if you know this. Did you know that today is Galentine's Day?
Galentine's.
Yeah, it's the pre-Valentine's Day for the ladies out there to hang out with their ladies and go gal it up. So right now, okay, we are living in Galentine's Day. I immediately was like, well, if there's a galentine, there has to be a palin. Like, how do I hang out with my buddy Jason? What day is this? There is a Palentine's Day. But Palentine's Day is inclusive to all people at that point. So you can hang out with, I guess, platonic non-girlfriend girls. You can hang out with anyone and everyone, which kind of rubs me the wrong way because I want a pal's day. So we're going to figure this out. We have, what do you call when it's dudes want to hang out and, you know, just talk about their feelings? I call it a Thursday night at 8 p.m. Raising Anchor, but like, what else do people call it out? I don't know. So yeah, but other than that, for those that are listening tomorrow on the commute, happy Valentine's Day as well. We know we got a lot of road warriors there. So whether you're a Galentine's, Palentine's, or Palentine's is really hard to say. It's, and Spellcheck does not want that word to be a thing. It wants to correct to definitely not a political podcast. We're not going to go
there.
Sounds
like a video game or something.
Isn't that a stock? That's Palantir. Anyways, we're not going to get there. We have so much to go over tonight. Obviously, lots of people want to hear about the USL news that dropped earlier today. Love when they drop things on a Thursday, by the way. It makes life really easy.
Yeah, they knew.
They appreciated us for once. Before we get to that, though, we're going to talk about a few other things around the horn. We had some signings that we wanted to go over because I think it's important for Rhode Island FC fans to understand kind of what's going to be shaking up around the competition and like who we can expect to see, whether it's famous names or just, you know, players to kind of be put out on awareness to. So kind of looking around the horn for last week's signings of measure of importance. First, we have Bill Hamid joining the Miami FC.
DC United legend. Honestly, I thought he was retired. You tell me he's 34 years old. I'm like, what?
I'm not sure that he wasn't not retired. And then just like, I still want to play. You know, keepers, they have that longer lifespan. They can go a little bit further in the distance here. It's interesting for Miami. You know, this is their third, you know, quote unquote, veteran MLS player that they've now signed. This experiment is getting more and more exciting to watch, where we may be on the cusp of something glorious, or we may about to see Miami's wheels completely come off. Like, they had a bad season last year. They could get 0 points.
They're trying. Maybe they're trying to start their own Galacticos. So who knows?
Who knows? Moving on, the biggest signing I think of the week. Not to bury it here, but I know Rhode Island FC fans are going to hate this. Cal Jennings joins the Charleston Battery. You know, people have been asking themselves, how will the Battery retool in the offseason, losing one of the most offensive firepower pieces in the USL? They finally announced it this week with their marquee signing of Cal Jennings, now wearing the yellow and black. Jennings scored, by the way, 16 goals last season, including one against us in our, second game ever? And then also earned 3 assists on the season. Not really a fan of seeing him stay in the East.
Yeah, you hate to see it. But it is a big signing here for Charleston Battery. He's obviously a great player. I kind of think about the Nick Markanik-sized hole that was left in their offense, and will Cal Jennings be able to fill that? You know, that is yet to be seen. We'll just kind of have to wait. But like you said, Cal Jennings has scored against us. If I remember correctly, Markanik didn't score against us, did he?
No, Charleston Battery, he struggled with them up against us.
He
for
struggled
sure.
against us. So
I will say, though, I don't think Cal is a type of player that needs much to be effective. You know, he's obviously benefited from incredible service in this last year with the Rowdies. But when you also look at what he can do, you know, I think, and we look at what, you know, also we have to take into account what the Battery have in that midfield. They've got Aaron Malloy, who led the league above Louisville in some cases with chance creation. And then, of course, they've got, Juan Gabriel Torres, or what is it? It's the new guy that did the...
That sounds right.
He did the Malloy equivalent of the kick during the playoffs against us. So it's great that we're basically bringing the band back together. We're going to go down there just replicating the Eastern quarterfinal all over again with some new dangerous set pieces.
I mean,
there.
Hey, maybe at least from a sporting terms, maybe we can develop a rivalry there. Seems like another team is not really carrying their weight.
I will say this. When we do our Eastern-Western preview show, it's looking harder and harder to see how Rhode Island FC will kind of line up in that prediction, because before some of these transfers came out, you know, I was riding high on the we're going to take third place, maybe even second place. Now with Charleston kind of rearming, Louisville not changing much, if not they're getting better, and then of course Birmingham Legion, we may be eyeing for that third or fourth spot there. You know, I don't think there's a team right now that's better than us past that, but we'll figure that out in the future episode. And then one more just kind of landed across our desk. I don't know how you feel about this. We won't see this player, if at all, until the end of the season, literally the end of the regular season. Gideon Zalam signing with New Mexico United, Arsenal legend. I don't. How do you feel about that?
I don't know. I mean, you know, that is interesting to see how he will fare. You know, if I do remember from his time at the Arsenal, I don't remember him getting a ton of minutes.
No, he was the sensational young youth national product that broke out with the men's national team, got scooped up by Arsenal. It was brief. It was beautiful. I mean, there are some, you go look at his highlight reel, like he still, for the moments that he got, he made the most of his time.
Yeah, he's clearly a very talented player. Sometimes I wonder about these players, you know, speaking of which, I need to check up on Nick Markanik, see how he's doing. But is it too big of a jump for them at times to kind of go all the way to the top? I think their like playing time at the end of the day is a lot more important.
Ryan Healy's saying Morris Dugan made sure he did no such thing on the Nick Markanich piece. Listen, with this one, I don't disagree. I think that he's definitely moving further and further backwards, right? Like he started at the top and now he keeps going back. I've heard that there's been some tragedy and some like circumstance in his, I don't know if it's his personal and professional career. I'm not close enough to him. It's just when you hear a name like that who you haven't heard in a while, you are kind of curious when you start to connect the dots. Like where did you go that you went from Premier League to MLS and now down to USL? It's interesting. And so I think this is a chance for him. He's got to be better than the average talent in the league. Like I'd be curious, like his points per game contribution, you know, his goals and assist contribution, average lifespan of his career. There's got to be something special to him. So I think this is New Mexico United making a statement, but only time will tell. And, you know, USL, you know, they're coming up in the world right now, especially with a certain bit of Division I effort that's coming along the way. I want to quickly get into this, you know, the bigger USL news. We were going to talk today about the USL 2 reorganization, obviously that has now kind of moved past, but they did do a reorg and you got to remember USL 2 is huge, right? It's the semi-pro, you know, division when it comes to the soccer pyramid, not just amongst USL, but in the entire landscape of the North American soccer pyramid. And the USL, this comes straight from Sam Minton at the Blazing Musket, but the USL finalized the 144 clubs that will take part in the 2025 USL 2 campaign. And we're going to specifically talk about the Northeast Division because this is where players and fans might be the most familiar with kind of the territory. A lot of it remains the same. You know, you've got the Seacoast United Phantoms, which were the winners of their region last year. The reason why Vermont Green is not in the Open Cup, but you have the Phantoms, the Western Mass Pioneers, Vermont Green FC, Boston Bolts, Albany Rush coming out of nowhere there, AC Connecticut, Black Rock FC, and Boston City FC are going to be the returning clubs. And then we talked about it a little earlier, that new team out of Worcester, the New England FC, which is just such a silly name.
Amazing.
so original. They're going to be coming up and bringing themselves up. Originally a youth academy, they're going to try to kind of cut their teeth here in USL 2 for 2025. Pathfinder FC will not be returning as they did not do so hot last season, so they're bowing out. Quick and fast here, Jason, USL 2. Noticing on this map, by the way, every state with the exception of Rhode Island and Maine have a USL 2 team. Do we need a USL 2 team to mix it up? Like, should we be calling Providence City Rogues and be like, what's up or whatever? How you doing?
Right now, probably not. I think if we see, you know, maybe a few years down the line, RFC to be a huge success, maybe there's a little more hankering for some soccer. Maybe we can find some sort of corner somewhere to throw a team into. But it is good to see the USL 2 continue. There was some off-season noise about changes to college regulations, and a lot of these teams, you know, rely on college kids for the bulk of their rosters. Like when we saw Vermont in the Open Cup, like before their season had even started. I mean, so that always can be a worry. But also with the news that just dropped, I don't know, maybe USL is doing pretty good.
So, and we'll see how that works out. It's always fun. You know, you talk about the greater part of the game, the bigger elements. We've became fans of Vermont Green overnight, and there's just an ample opportunity for fans who want to watch soccer across the board that are beyond just the normal casuals, but maybe not quite the sickos. There's a space for them to watch it, but let's not bury the lead. Let's talk about the big thing here. So we'll start here with the USL announcing the formation of a Division I league that will start play in the 2027 season. The USL announced plans to launch a Division I men's professional league in 2027, bringing the highest level of soccer to more communities across the country. USL President Paul McDonough said this was a natural next step for the league as it studied how to expand the impact after the 2026 World Cup, which the U.S., Canada, and Mexico will co-host. He had an incredible article. The Athletic went out of their minds in how much information they collected because, you know, we got the press release and it's the cut and paste of like, yeah, we're going to grow the brand. We're going to grow the soccer in the community. But the Athletic kind of really honed in on a lot of other key details. So he went on to talk about, it's a key moment for soccer in this community, and we see where this game is going. We want to be a part of it, McDonough said in an exclusive interview with The Athletic. Taking this big initiative allows for the growth of the game throughout the country. It's important to understand here, the move to start a first division would give the USL a full three-tier pyramid, which you see on the screen. We just made up a graphic for USL. We're calling it Premier because it looks like they're trying to emulate the English football system. It could be called something completely different. They may need to, you know, quote unquote, Americanize it. I chose an eagle for the logo because instead
amazing.
Of, a, you know, it's a lion for England. So it's like, we're going bald eagle for America. Could you imagine this is what they use, by the way? And like, they like find out like, Matt, what did you do? Like, we weren't going to reveal this for 3 years. You've ruined everything. But anyways, so with that being said, with this pyramid now, you do have the USL Premier at top. You have then USL Championship, which we are currently a part of in Division 2. USL 1 would remain in Division 3, and then you have USL League 2 in that semi-pro outfit. The article goes on, though, and we're going to touch on a bunch of it here, but they do go on to talk about how this is just the first step to differentiate themselves. But in addition to that, they've been very public about trying to get into the ProRail space. They needed the right conduit, the right system to be able to add that. So ProRail has been thrown back into the mix. You know how much of an exciting talking point that is. And then they went on, though, and this is where it gets really interesting. They go on to continue talking about how they've basically been ready to announce this for a while, but they knew that with the NASA antitrust lawsuit against MLS, they wanted to wait and see kind of where the chips fell, right? Where did the dust settle on that whole thing?
Yeah, see how that shakes up.
Yeah. And so from that point, they said that they could have probably produced this information a lot sooner. I'm betting that if they hadn't heard that there was a trial date ready to go in January, this probably would have come out right after the success of the USL Cup final that we were a part of, because you had record viewership with the CBS deal. You know, there's not really much left now. It's like, hey, how do we get fans, you know, jazzercised and pumped about what this league is going to come about and become? And so my guess is they kind of had to sit on this news. I don't have the details right, but like November 23rd, 2 months, like this isn't a decision you take lightly. So I wouldn't be surprised if they had this ready to go for a while. So they weren't waiting for that. It has nothing to do with the lawsuit, but they wanted to wait nevertheless. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And then they said this last remark, which really kind of is where I want to drill down with you on this. If soccer in this country is truly going to grow, it's going to grow outside of 30 or 32 markets, kind of talking about how what MLS has built in terms of their empire, how they see the soccer hierarchy. This is basically, it's not a shot fired across the bow. I want to be really clear about that. MLS and USL are completely able to cohabitate in the same arena, but in different spaces. But this was really, this is where we really want to kind of lean into it. Now, before we break down the USL side of things, I want to just throw out here, we went out and asked for a quote from Brett Johnson because I'm working on an article for the Musket, and I wanted to make sure that we got all the kind of information correct. So I said, hey, what does Brett think about this? Like, he's an owner. He's been very positive about ProRail. He's been an advocate for it. He believes in the USL. He's all in on all of that. And he went on to write, back to the club, which they made an official statement. We applaud USL's announcement on the intent to launch a Division One league. As the future of soccer is bright in the United States, Rhode Island FC and our stadium are well positioned to be a part of this league. And we welcome exploring this when the time is right. Brett Johnson. I don't know how you read between the lines, but we're in this Division One. I mean, that's you know, Brett Johnson is all in on this.
Oh, yeah. He wants to be there. I mean, I think there was potentially some aspirations back there in the Phoenix days to maybe move that up to MLS. That kind of never came to fruition. At this point, he's kind of moved on, divested from that, and, you know, gone all in when it comes to RAFC. So especially when you talk about the fact that there were already plans to be able to expand to 15,000, it's like they knew.
I mean, and we're seeing that now. A lot of these clubs that are building these soccer-specific stadiums, they could have, you know, lowered it down to a 10,000 capacity. Because right now in Division II, the requirement is only 5,000. So, you know, and that's why you see some of these stadiums only targeting 7,500 with the capacity to potentially grow out beyond, you know, that number and scale maybe to 10. But then other venues are looking at the 10,000 marker to be able to expand to 15, or they're just going straight for 15 as a target to expand to 25, right? Like we've heard some of the new modular designs are going to do that. So it's easy to understand that. I think where it gets interesting and where we really want to talk about the requirements themselves, and I'm curious what your thoughts here are, but I do want to share for the audience who isn't listening to all the other content out there, there are some barriers. Like this isn't something that's just going to happen, right? Like 2027 is the target, but there are some things that need to happen along the way. So let's go over and kind of talk about the stuff that needs to happen for this to kind of click through.
Yeah. So for this to actually come to fruition, there are some division requirements here. So a minimum of 12 member clubs at launch, with the expectation that 14 by the third year of operation. 75% of the clubs have to be located in the U.S., as well as in a metro area with a population exceeding 1 million. The capacity of each club stadium must exceed 15,000. Actively operating in at least 3 time zones. And a principal owner with at least 35% stake in the team whose net worth is at least 40 million. And or a group of owners whose combined net worth is at least 70 million. and has the financial viability to operate for 5 years. There's definitely some interesting stuff here when we try and unpack some of this. When we look at, all right, number of clubs. Well, USL continues to expand every year. No problem there.
Well, this would be for Division One, though.
Yeah, right?
This is the ones that would be eligible to enter into Division One.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I just meant as we like go through and like kind of talk through some of these points here. So first one, doesn't seem to be much of an issue there. 75% of the clubs located in the U.S. With over a million. I think we're decently there, right? I mean, we don't, you know,
can we talk
Bad
about
Bunny
that,
FC hasn't showed up yet. I'm not sure if they're going to count that.
Well, I mean, that's technically a U.S.
technically,
colony, so
but
I think that would
work. Will they count it?
Well, I think that has to, I think,
like
I
how
think,
is that viewed? Because these are FIFA rules, correct?
Not, no, this is U.S. soccer requirements. Okay. And I think that one, that particular line, which in the rule that you see on the screen, I blended it with two. It's the million population exceeding requirement, right? So that way you're getting into the right audiences. But there's another one that's just kind of like listed deeper down that 75% of the clubs need to be in America. I think that's an MLS rule that they had to append for the Canadian teams. Because remember, they have three teams in Canada right now. So I think they had to make sure that they could include those. But then again, because remember, these are posts that have been made because of all the experimentation that they worked with MLS to understand that if you did want to take your team out of there. What I'm also curious then is that isolated to North America? Could we get a team out of like Iceland, or could we go the other direction, get a
America
team out of Mexico?
Team.
I mean, think about all the times that a Mexican team tried to like, you know, FC Chivas, right? Chivas USC or USA. Like, could we just go the other route? I don't know, but that was a really curious tagline there. And then the financial stake part, you know, if someone asked like, and we'll talk about the questions all at the end, we'll do a separate recording just because this is going to go long, but someone had mentioned, you know, can the clubs afford this? Well, that's part of the vestiture of the ownership groups, right? They have to be able to demonstrate a capacity to operate this club for 5 years at least, and they have to have a certain amount of, you know, capital ready to go. So if they're going to upgrade themselves into this, they have to be in that capacity. We've got the legendary Kaler. Kaler's been dropping truth bombs all across the night here. He mentioned that the USL NCAA double conversation was not applicable that we had mentioned last week. He did
correct. Yeah, I saw that.
League 2 is part of the pyramid in my heart, Kaler. So that's why we put it in there. And then also he mentioned that Rhode Island FC, you know, would fit the stadium requirement going through the application process. We're going to talk in a second about the teams that would qualify by the dimensions of these Division One requirements or who are close to knocking on the door. So all kind of lines point to RIFC being the chosen club, or at least one of the chosen clubs. And then the 1 million rule has to be 75% of the clubs. So yeah, that's also correct there, like we said. And then RIP Ottawa Fury, gone but never forgotten. So listen. If you haven't read John Morrissey's article on Backheeled yet, you need to go and read that because, one, he covers a lot of great aspects of the challenges of this. When this first dropped, you know, the first thing I thought about was the, you know, 15,000 stadium attendance requirement for the capacity, because today only three stadiums fit that. And surprise, none of them are owned by the clubs that they operate in. They're all rented spaces. They're all temporary. And also, too, they're kind of max, like they're way higher in terms of capacity than those clubs probably need right now. So it doesn't really benefit just to say like, oh, we have this space that's not really our own. But the thing that I want to start this piece with, because everyone got really excited with the words ProRel at the beginning when that was announced as this is a step towards that goal. ProRel cannot come in 2027. I don't think ProRel would come for probably 5 years after, at a minimum, after this Division One is started and kind of off the ground, because it's the same problem today that we would have in the championship, where if a team goes up, how do they meet these requirements? How do they succeed in the 15,000 capacity? How do they have the volume and the ownership funding to go and do this? Like, you want to hear the story of Union Omaha climbing all the way up to Division One, but that's going to take time. And likewise, if some of these teams fall off and go down, what happens to them? So, like, I think this is a step in the right direction, but there's no way that we're going to get this year one, year two. We may not get this for 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, and when you expand it further into looking at the finances and whatnot, how do we protect the viability of the league? Right, I don't know all the mechanics, but there are, you know, that there's money essentially from the Premier League that helps the entire football system. So, you know, have we thought about things like this to protect the integrity of the league in terms of the whole, you know, rising tide lifts all boats kind of thing here? Whereas the top gets more successful, can we make sure that we aren't losing people here and that we're getting proper coverage for these smaller teams, that they're getting like at least a YouTube stream or something of their game, right? Right. So you can at least, you know, have that full system where top to bottom, there is some sort of avenue to explore and be excited about the pyramid in, you know, in totality.
I mean, I just found out about yo-yo clubs the other day from listening to Unfiltered with Landon Donovan and Tim Howard, where there are clubs that take the financial incentives of getting promoted and then the financial protections of going and dropping back down.
Oh, parachute payments, yeah.
Yeah, and then they go back up and then they go back down. So they, in some way, it's a high-risk strategy.
Norwich City.
It was Norwich, exactly. I mean, it's a high-risk strategy because if you miss it 1 year, all of those, you know, all of that kind of goes away and then you may never climb back up. But those are the kinds of things that you have to think about, like the financial investment that's going to go into this. It's not just the pride of the badge and saying we're up or, oh no, we've gone down. There's so much more that goes on to it here.
All right, so who is our yo-yo club? too good for the championship, not good enough for the premiership.
It's got to be, I'd have to go, see, we're still too new in the league to like look back in the six plus years of history. If Kaler's still on, I think we'd have to ask him. I feel like there's like a fringe team that's always around like the seventh or eighth position in...
Oh, Loudon. Okay, right.
Loudon would be a good one. Yeah, like, maybe. Again, kind of no one really knows what they're about, so they could go down, but they're not someone that you would... Actually, you know what? No, North Carolina FC. Because literally they self-relegated when they were the Railhawks down, and then they promoted themselves back up. So I'm going to go with North Carolina FC right now as the potential yo-yo club of those two. But they wouldn't meet... They wouldn't meet the requirements for the most part to get into the new Premier League that we're going to call it. I want to also talk about real fast the expansion overall. And, you know, a lot of people are saying, oh, this is MLS. This is competition for MLS. Like, what are we going to do? I think we also need to pause that comment system as well. Like, we need to put the brakes on it because this is in a lot of ways is really good. You know, when they were talking Pro Rel, and I'm not talking about that for the D1 inclusion. I'm just talking about the Pro Rel here for a second. They had said this was the X factor. This was the differentiation that we needed to distinguish ourselves and be two separate entities and products. I think now when you look at what this is going to be in combination to what the decisions MLS has made and are continuing to make, I don't see this as big of an issue because it was really interesting in the press release and as well in the Athletic and Guardian articles. You know, they made a fair point about talking about how MLS, they can't really go anywhere. They've locked themselves in. If they expand further, you're basically going into conference systems. You're emulating a version of the NFL or the other major sports. But like, where do you still want to go to grow your game? If we're going to sit here and say that there's only 30 cities in this country that are deserving of high-quality soccer products, that's a crazy statement. So from this aspect, when you look at what USL has kind of locked themselves or unlocked themselves from, I should say, now whether you look at it from all three systems, one, championship, and you know, premier, if you take it even at the lowest number of 20 teams, that's 60 teams that can kind of cohabitate. If you move the target to 30 like MLS has, that's 90 teams. That is 90 markets that we can grow the game in that will be denied that MLS can never touch because they want to be a closed system in just one single league.
Yeah, and you need 500 million.
and that's the other part, right? So people were talking today like, I don't understand how this is going to be better or different. We've joked off pod about the what $1 billion actually looks like, because I don't think people fathom the amount of money that $1 billion is.
It's a billion more than a million.
Exactly.
It's absurd.
Right. Like they did like the days. I always remember the days. It's like, if you count it by, was it seconds? A million seconds is like 5 days or 30 days. And then like a billion seconds is like 37 years. Like, those numbers, don't quote me on those numbers, but they are
something
way off.
Like that. Yeah, it's.
But so having said that, you know, we sometimes have to scrape by on some investors and some ownerships that haven't been able to find, is this worth it for us to invest in, right? This isn't a D1 product, so we're always in the shadow of MLS. Well, now we're going to enter on the same playing field. Suddenly you find an investor who's got $20 million that they want to put in, but they don't want to put $500 million in just for the permission to play in. Like, remember, because the expansion fee is the expansion fee. That is not the operating costs of a club. that cuts off a lot of the wealth in this country. We don't have that many billionaires. So suddenly you have access. It's like venture capitalism, where they have the first round, you know, the A-class shares, and they go, okay, who wants in on the ground? And then like people see it like, oh, that's an exciting product. I want in. Like, oh, you'll have to wait for the second round of investing. We're basically going to be capturing second round investors here that have a lot more money, because there are more millionaires than there are billionaires. So from that standpoint too, there's kind of like a limitless growth potential when it comes to the investment and the competitiveness then that comes with that. But then the final piece, and why I really don't think that these things are going to matter, is if MLS really wants to move to the European window for its competitions, that's the best thing we could ever ask about. You and I talk all the time that when Revs go to Boston, it will be the best thing that ever happens to Rhode Island FC. This is more of that. Because if they move to that calendar structure, one, like, not the best weather. I don't think I would go to games, you know, in January 5th and hang out. I don't think I have that in me.
Went to some of those early games that were miserable. It was like 38 degrees. It was pouring. It was very close to like just turning into straight up snow.
Right.
I mean, it's fun from an optics wise, but you can always get that from other leagues who right. have like, you know, like one of the requirements, what is the underheated pitch in the Premier League and stuff like that. Like, we're not there yet, right? Maybe in 50 years, if we really develop a soccer culture in this country, then we could put underheated pitches and really get into it. But at the end of the day, we still have to realize, like, this is still not the most popular sport here. It is clearly growing, and acceptance, like, generation by generation is increasing. So in a way, it does feel like a sport of the future. And so looking at building a pyramid here, like, the ultimate goal has to be pro rail here, right? Because MLS is always going to have more money. If they go to the European schedule like everyone else, they can continue to buy expensive stars and do all that kind of thing. And that's fine for the people who want to just go off and say, I want to support the quote unquote best thing. But we've met so many people in our travels and random fandoms of like people who are very casual in terms of fandom in soccer in America, because it's not quote-unquote authentic. If you could present to them, hey, look, it's maybe not the best, but your local team is in a relegation battle right now, or like imagine how great it would be to relegate Hartford like on the last day, like that. You don't get that kind of, like, there's too many meaningless games in MLS.
Yeah, but like
hashtag not an MLS podcast.
But where I'm going with this, like, I appreciate all the accuracy of what you were saying just now. But where I'm going with it is the actual competition. Like, you're talking about the authenticity of the product, and I do agree 100%. I also think, though, that they're
tied hand in hand, right? If games mean something, then,
well, hold on.
There's competitiveness there.
I agree. But like, let's also talk, I think, and this is the thing that MLS is taking the gamble on, which is interesting because they're hoping that the World Cup does the heavy lifting here. And that is that 12% to 20% spike you see every World Cup cycle, where you grab the attention of the casual fan. Right. You snare them in, you make it something exciting, and then they get hooked. Right. Then they commit their lives, their financial wallets to it. The difference here is that if MLS moves to that, and I think what they've gotten too big, they've forgotten their roots here to a certain extent, is this game was grown organically. We talked about this. This game is grown organically inside the communities. I don't know a single person that watched the game on the television, and I'm talking like an MLS game, and was like, yep, that's me. I want that. Put more of that in my body. It's always been, hey, let me take you to a game. We saw that this year in the transformation of Rhode Island fans, right? They were skeptical. They were McCoy holdouts, or they were like, soccer's boring. And then they came to a game and they're like, oh my gosh, I need this every weekend as often as possible. That's the magic of soccer. That's the magic of live soccer. And so when you look at what MLS is trying to do, they're going the route of the NFL. They're trying to capture the broadcast dollars, the broadcast revenue, and they're trying to become a sport designed for television. It's no different in like the English system or in any soccer system, right? Like, there's only so many tickets available at a game, so they rely heavily on people being able to watch it. The difference is in those cultures, it's rooted into them. It's a part of their DNA that they were born into it. So here, if MLS wants to kind of abandon a lot of the, let's call it, the atmosphere and the game day experience that goes into that. Because let's be honest, not every stadium sells out. I can tell you I've gone to many a game in my favorite team as well as other teams around the league. You usually can get a ticket, and it's not because there's a high demand for it. If they're banking on just the Apple TV deal or something like that, fine, let them have it. USL keeps the summer window. They keep all of the games during the summer. And by the way, I've heard this whole competition thing, like, oh, we're, you know, by moving to the European schedule, they remove the NFL. Like, the NFL starts in September. The league is MLS is basically done with six games left by September, and then it's playoffs. And like, if your team's in, you're going to go watch your team regardless of the love of other sports. If anything, this doesn't make sense to me because they're going to be competing more with the NFL by switching to the European system. So like, I've always considered this soccer programming, this soccer format, to be the best schedule possible, because the only thing you really compete with is baseball, and baseball's on the decline. Baseball, you know, like, it's apples to oranges there. So different channels means that you're getting soccer 365 almost. They're not really competing in the same spaces anymore, and yet they'll be considered the same division. I think this is the best outcome possible to grow the game in North America.
Yeah.
So
I think so. But yeah. Are we going to go all night just on this here?
I mean, we might as well, right? But I do want to talk about really quickly, again, if you didn't read the John Morrissey article, lots of good stuff, lots more breakdowns of the things that matter in this conversation. But I do want to bring up on the screen the teams that we believe are within the kind of ability to expand into Division One, and this is strictly by soccer stadiums. Everything we're talking about tonight is not about the market cap. It's not about the financial stability. It's strictly off of the hardest requirement, which Jason talked about earlier, being those stadium expansions. So when you look at the screen here, and it's important to note, none of these stadiums that you see on the screen are at the ability today to host 15,000 people in their stadium right now. All of these would require some sort of upgrade or enhancement to be able to fit those final numbers. So you've got Sacramento Republic, modular stadium, but there's proposals to build a more permanent location now with the new ownership group. New Mexico United, they're in the ballpark at Isotope, but they're getting their own stadium. Obviously, this would have to now be into a grander design to accommodate that Division I certification. Detroit City, they're close to starting to build their own stadium. Everyone knows Rhode Island FC, although I will say we're currently at 10,000. So I asked the club today, can you commit if, like, we're basically going to start constructing the upper decks around the bowl? And the club, you read Brett's comment where it was like, you know, the stadium will be committed to if this is a path forward. So that's one. Las Vegas Lights, they don't own Cashman Field, but it's a baseball field and they can easily expand the outfield around it with some modular seating. Phoenix Rising, a modular stadium, they just add more to it. Indy 11, you know, you almost want to put an asterisk to this one because they're trying to get their stadium online. Maybe this is the push they need so that their mayor that has been like blocking them every step of the way goes, oh, well, if you'll be D1, let's get that stadium back online for you. Pittsburgh, they own their stadium, so they could easily expand their seating. San Antonio, that's probably the closest one that can just like, I think they can actually already expand today, but I don't think they have the capacity, like the mechanism to do it. The Switchbacks own their stadium, so they just have to hang some more seats off of their Widener apartment building. Louisville, the Mecca, it's weird, by the way. I thought Louisville was already compliant with this. They only have 11,700 seats.
Interesting.
That is very weird to me. Like, they have, because they have that whole back empty, like, barbecue bar area. So, like, they just need to put seats in that, I guess, to be compliant. And then Tampa Bay is just like Cashman Field with the lights. Alang just needs some more expansion around like the outfield line there. The only one on here is Lexington. They just built their stadium. It's 7,500. It can expand to 11,000. But I feel like if they needed to, like, they could instantly find a way to get 4,000 more seats in there. Is there any stadium in here that makes sense that shouldn't be on this list, or should we move on?
No, I think that's a decent start in terms of the list. At this point, we imagine with the news, if teams weren't already thinking about it, they're probably starting to plan, okay, if this comes to fruition, what options do we have to either relocate to a new stadium? Like, is there any available land in the area? Do, you know, kind of starting to make those plans for the future.
Well, Kaler said right at the end of their show before we hopped on that he had read in a press release or a statement somewhere that the league had already identified some teams and should be announcing some of the earliest inclusions or introductory members into the Division I system. I mean, obviously they would have had to plan all of this in advance and they needed to vet it with each of the clubs. I couldn't find that anywhere. So I'm just, this is complete hearsay and I trust Kaler on it, but that would be interesting to see which teams are the first ones actually announced in the system. And then you do have, so these are the other three teams, and these are the ones we mentioned a minute ago that have, you know, the expanded footprint, right? So we've got Oakland roots at the Coliseum, Birmingham Legion playing out of Protective, and then Miami playing at Mr. Worldwide. Those are all much larger venues, but the problem is none of these teams currently own them, so the capacity may be a little bit suspicious there. We got some feelers in the chat that Ryan Healy believes Lou City will go first and announce. I don't disagree. I mean, Lou's the premier team, right? They do everything the right way, so I would not be surprised. And he also said that Pittsburgh would have been the yo-yo club in the format we talked about earlier. And then finally, this is the interesting one, because we're not talking about it. It feels too far away, but it's coming right around the corner. You have to consider the expansion teams that would be impacted by a USL Premier Division, a Division I. We looked into the teams that are coming online, and there's four possibilities that could actually be incorporated into this, because you have to remember, they're either in the process of building their stadiums right now, or they're in the process of getting it's like Dallas, right? USL, it's in Garland. They have the site. You know, now they just need to go back to their architect and say, hey, I need you to up the numbers here.
There are a few more seats in there.
Find a way to add 10 more seats.
What, I'm trying to remember. It's been a while since I've thought about their stadium. What was the projected Brooklyn?
Well, so hold on. We'll talk about that in a second. Okay. So the four expansions, one that are on the TV or on the screen, excuse me, for our audio only. OKC Energy, because they're going through a complete rebrand as well as a new stadium design. They got all the approvals for that. It's in downtown. I think it's right next to the Oklahoma City Thunder Stadium. Nice. You've got USL to Garland, or they're calling it Dallas. And then Sporting Jacks, they've insinuated that they're going to try to find a way to do this. And then you have Ozark United. I added Ozark because something's really special about this club early on. I feel like they're in the same process that Rhode Island FC was 2 years ago. They're putting content out. They're constantly talking to the fans. They've been really transparent. Currently, the stadium's only designed to be one of those 7,500 that can expand to 11,000. But when you look at the space that they're building in, if they need to get to 15, I don't see why that would be a barrier for them. Brooklyn is going to be a problem because they're playing out of that old park that's in the Coney Island area. They can't touch that from a renovation standpoint, so they can't expand that to it. They do meet the criteria of having enough people in the city as well as probably the investor groups, but Brooklyn currently does not meet the demands of that. But I'm going to be honest, man, I don't even know if Brooklyn's going to make it, because after not being able, and it was such a last minute thing.
You mean Liquid Death FC? Liquid Death
may die. Liquid Death FC may die. Or at least the men's version. They may just stick with the women's team, who's seen some tremendous success in their inaugural season in the Super League. But I have my reservations that they'll even pull out as a full club there. So with that being said, I'm going to throw this last graphic up. This is just the map of what we kind of envision are the teams possible to enter. So this doesn't mean it will be all of them. Remember, it has to be 12 teams in year one. So in 2027, we will at least see 12 of these teams. And then by year three, 14 teams, which this all accomplishes. And this is kind of a nice shakedown. I mean, you take one or two out of here and you've got basically six in the West, and then you've got six in the East. You could go to 14 right away, and then, you know, San Antonio stays on that west side of the line, and then you have seven on the other side, right? I think that this is a great way to start things. Is there anything that you see that maybe shouldn't be here, or does this look right to you?
No, I love the idea of Mr. Worldwide Stadium being part of the premiership. I know, I'm just joking
there. But it's not, so here's the thing, though, right? And it's the same thing with Oakland, because Oakland's in a temporary venue with the Coliseum. Both of these teams have committed to build. Rather, Oakland's got like three site options right now. They've got like the parking lot at the Coliseum, but they've also got this new waterfront thing that they're trying to do. Miami's building in Homestead. So again, if they want to take this serious, they're going to, when they move down, they're going to have to look for 15,000.
Yeah, and I mean, with all the signings that they've made this year, like there's some sort of effort there. Maybe it's not working out too well for them, but they're trying.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's really kind of like the point that you mentioned with Brooklyn FC a second ago is, now more than ever, it's going to be really important for anyone that wants to start building a soccer club, even if it's at the USL 1 level. One, you got to get the property.
Scalability.
You got to get the stadium, and you have to scale. Right. Like, I feel like, honestly, too many times they pulse the interest. They go, okay, there's soccer fans here, not realizing that those are committed to like the broader market leagues or just like the world game. And then they go, cool, we made a cool logo and we're going to get some fans. And so it's just all going to work out. We have money to like burn. I think this is really going to cement, because like Brooklyn can't make it. Santa Barbara Sky, they're not in the conversation to be even a part of Division One. at this point. They can hold out for 2 more years and they could have gone from USL 1 to USL Championship to USL Premier and they still wouldn't be able to earn their way. So I think it's important now with ownerships that come online that they see this and say, hey, like, we need to make sure that we take this a little as serious as possible down the road. But there is one thing that I want to talk about, because with that, if you see that Rhode Island FC could move, make the jump up, does that mean, Jason, that we may lose our cross New England rival in the, is this a loss that we can sustain? Because if Hartford's not coming along, they'd have to have massive transformation of their infrastructure. And as it is right now, that's a 5,000 capacity stadium. I won't make any jokes about how they fill it, but they can't join us in Division One. So is it worth it to go to Division One right away and then not be able to get a look at our, I mean, maybe with the Jägermeister Cup, maybe that was this first step to get people prepared for that. US Open Cup could always, but now we're going to go from like, oh, we see these guys 5 times a year to now we'll just see them once.
I mean, there's definitely some good rivalries out there where teams are not in the same divisions and they really do not like each other. You know, Sunderland and Newcastle absolutely despise each other, and it's been quite a while since they've been in the same league. At this point, it's only been a year. They really haven't showed much in terms of rivalry except for shenanigans. So if they're not going to get it together, I mean, in terms of, we can have other sporting, you know, rivalries with other teams in the league. Obviously, we'll always dislike them because it's Hartford. But maybe that kind of makes those matches just a little bit sweeter when we don't play them like 5 times next season.
So we've made the jokes, right? You know, like, it's too many games. Well, maybe now enjoy them while they last, because we're going to, again, feast and famine. We're going to go from an abundance of them to the well will dry up rather quickly. I don't like it, but I also would not want Brett Johnson and company to shrink away from the opportunity to go into Division One status. So that's a bit tough. That one hurts a little, but, you know, hey, that's Hartford's problem. They could have done the same thing we did, you know?
Yeah, they just need to get it together.
Story of their lives. Speaking of Hartford, really fast, I want to touch on the USL Show's badge crest ranking. It swept the fan base earlier this week. It would only take a USL announcement of Division One to derail the momentum that the badge ranking had. I'm going to throw the one that I did up on the screen. We never confirmed what yours might be, so I want to do this live with you. Don't confirm my list. I'm curious. If you had to rank first Rhode Island FC's badge, where would you rank it in the S, A, B, C, D, F tiers?
I haven't had the time. I've been a little busy with work. And then, of course, this, I had some free time today and I thought, oh, I'll knock one out. And then, of course, the USL dropped the bombshell news that kind of consumed my entire day. So admittedly, I don't have one. I would think I would put RAFC at an S or an A. Like, either there. Is that
because you're a fan or because you recognize the brilliance of the crest?
Sure. But I also am a biased in the sense that, you know, we saw this great design doc where they kind of explained all of the different choices of the designs, what they signify. And I really appreciate all the thought that goes into the design. It's clean. It's simple. It's not too busy. I think it's a really good logo. So if I were to sit down and create one, it'd be up there in the one of those top two tiers.
Okay. What about any other badges around the league? Is there anyone else?
If I had to, off the top of my head, you know, I don't really like when teams put stars in their logos and they haven't won anything.
I don't like stars in general, to be honest. Stars and soccer balls.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the only team I'll give a pass to, I think, Red Star Belgrade, just because of their, like, historic.
Sure.
Like a big club in Europe. But, like, outside of that, like, come on, what are you doing? I mean, maybe they knew that was the only way they ever could get one.
I actually agree. Someone wrote a message to me on when I released the ranking about my anti-soccer ball, but I had put Phoenix Rising way higher up the list. And credit to Phoenix Rising. I totally didn't remember that that's a soccer ball because it's integrated so artistically into it that...
Yeah, there's a way to do it. I think if you put stars and soccer balls on that and you are a amateur team, sure, go for it. But if you're going to put a professional product out there and expect people to wear your merch, it has to be such a way that, like, I honestly forgot about that, too. It's like, oh, yeah, that is like a flaming ball. Of course, in Phoenix, it's 115, so it probably is melting. So that makes sense.
Did you, before we move on, did you have any actual officially S that you would like give a nod to as in terms of competition around the Super Championship or One Leagues?
What's the, there's one that's kind of controversial. I forget. Is it the Ascent, Carolina Ascent?
Yeah, Mountains FC.
So I like the colors. I feel like those are not typical colors for sport teams. Like the oranges and the purple lavender is the kind of sunset there. I really appreciate that they did that.
But it has a soccer ball on it, Jason. We just went for 2 minutes about soccer balls.
See, all I saw was the colors.
If you took that logo and you took away the team name on it, that logo could insert on a generic Old Navy t-shirt that just says like soccer mom underneath it. Like, and people are like, yeah, I get it. That has nothing to, I'm sorry. That's not, I disagree with you. If that's your takes need to be worked on there. The correct answer was El Paso Locomotive. It's a train. It's just like ours. It's shaped like a boat. Theirs is shaped like a train.
See, like I see where you're coming from, but the problem is that it's so bulky that I wouldn't realize that.
How dare you? How dare you?
Yeah, I'm not a fan.
I will tell you this though, what we're going to do next, once the commotion of USL Division I news kind of calms down, let's do a mascot one. I've already got the images ready to go, so we should do it. We should drop a mascot ranking of all of the mascots, past, present, and future, I guess, for Rhode Island, but for all of USL that I can drum up. Let's move on. We are running so behind here.
We're still doing news, aren't we?
We're still in the news segment, but this one's important here.
Yeah, so the Defiance has announced an official partnership with the Guild. I think this is great news. The postseason watch parties at the Guild last season were absolutely electric. I mean, one practically got shut down. And I mean, Defiance had been going there all season. You know, they had kind of built up that partnership before, and it started off respectable, right? We saw a decent, I think the very first away watch party was maybe somewhere around 50 people or so. And then as the season continued, you know, we did have our struggles, right? Lots of draws. So that being said, I don't think we ever got below, let's say, maybe 25 people. But as the team picked up momentum, second half of the seasons, crowds continued to get bigger and bigger until they just kind of, like I alluded to, they exploded at the end of the year. So
shut down, so to speak. Yeah. Doors closed, people denied.
So I imagine people will remember that experience. And, you know, I imagine because this is official, the Guild might put a little more effort into kind of promoting this too on their socials. So you'll get some more people say, oh, hey, I did that last year. That was fun. I'm not doing anything.
Yeah. I there was a healthy number of people that got converted from just seeing people. Like I remember there was a guy who was there for, I think it was a Chelsea game or was he a Tottenham? I don't know. He was one of the
Tottenham.
Two. It was the Tottenham guy. And he's like, I had no idea this existed. I'm coming back for just now the Rhode Island FC side of things. So it's impactful. And, you know, what I can say that I know that the partnership it continues to have is, one, Defiance went out and, you know, they came back this time around with, I don't want to say a list of demands, but, you know, they had some expectations around saying, hey, if we're going to do this again, you can't, you know, have Kumbaya night and have an acoustic guitar session competing with the volume of us being able to watch the game. And because there were some schedule conflicts over the past, you know, there was, hey, we're going to have a 10 p.m. game. We're not sure if we want to stay open for that. Like, well, no, you need, if you want to be our bar, you have to work through those things with us. So from what I understand, the Guild has made a full commitment that all regular season games, the playoffs, because of course that was huge for them, in addition to, I think the Jägermeister Open and Open Cup games will also, I don't know about if they advance in those, what that has been worked out, but every other game that's an away game will be there. So like when you talk about like having the ability to have a static home base, a location, that's just pivotal in order to like just always know where you want to go catch the game. I will make sure, and I want to make sure we say this for fans that listen that aren't a part of Defiance, you don't have to be a Defiance 1636 member to go to these watch parties. Like you should be, and we'll explain that in a second too, but like you don't need to be. So if you're interested in just like, oh, they're going to alienate me, they're going to try to harass me and sign me up for something, that's not how it works with them. They just want people to feel included and that there's a safe space. I wouldn't even say safe because it's rowdy, it's wild there, that there's a place that people can go.
Yeah, Rowdy's there sometimes.
Right.
But, I mean, also, just on that note really quick, too, like, even if you don't have any intent to ever going over there and maybe being a part of that, but you just like to see what's going on, you could just buy a membership because they get a really cool scarf.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things that it makes sense to become a Defiance member. And if I'm going to plug them, here's the plug. One, they're huge activists in the community. There's intent to help be part of like the Tidewater Restoration and Cleanup Act so that the area around the stadium is kind of beautified in that aspect. They already do the futsal tournaments with Mundo Listo. They're looking at expanding into some other charities. I think that they talked about having one of the dragon boats and competing in the dragon boat races. Like, it is, there's so much more to this community than just showing up for game days and watching a soccer event. They do have some special news dropping tomorrow. So if you're not a member, you really need to be, or I guess today for those of you listening on the download, you really need to be a member if you're interested in some really cool things that they do. Because I don't know if they're going to make that particular part outside of the Defiance, which I can't say more. That being said, I do want to put like a disclaimer out there. If you liked the Defiance and you've been kind of dragging your feet on joining them for the season next year, they did put out an official notice that they anticipate that all three of their sections are going to be sold out in the next couple of days. So I think there's about 10 days that they project based on the, because those are some of the best prices when it comes to tickets for this. They're projecting that for the entire season that section will be sold out. So if you've been interested in like just waiting and waiting, you have about 10 days to secure a ticket in that space. Otherwise, you're going to have to be going somewhere else around the stadium. So that's incredible news in and of itself for them. So congratulations to Defiance and everything else that goes on.
Congratulations.
And then in additional news with it, I also just want to drop something else because we've been talking a lot about the 5-3 home opener, as well as the first game of the season being against Charleston on March 15th. But it's important to actually spotlight the first game that you will see fans in force showing up for. And that's going to be that away game on Sunday, 4/27 at Memorial Field in Mount Vernon against the Westchester SC for the first round of the Jägermeister Cup. It's only 2.5 hours away to drive. And so there are fans in mass. Right now we're looking at over 75. And that's the soccer sickos because the club hasn't really promoted this. Westchester hasn't really promoted this. You know, they're trying to get everything going so fast that this is the first chance to see this club. Unless you're going to fly somewhere or travel, this is a commuter drive, so to speak, to be able to go down and watch it. So we're going to put a link out to if you want to attend so that you can be situated in the Defiant 1636 kind of section. Right now, it looks like it's kind of going to be an away takeover. The tickets are $26. If you don't use the link, but you're like looking on the websites that sell tickets, at section, I think, 109, it's the far left section. So you can easily do that. But we want to make sure we spotlight this game because this will probably be for a majority of Rhode Islanders or fans of Rhode Island FC. This may be the first access. I know it's only a week removed from the home opener, but like if you want to get that earlier week and you're tired of seeing them, you know, five games on the road, this might be your first chance.
Yeah. And I mean, if we look at this match here too, it's been a while since I played Train Simulator, but I'm pretty sure tickets are about $50 to $100. So
if you take the early morning train and the last train out, it's $50. If you want to take one of the ones that get you there a little closer to kickoff and like right after a game would be over, it's going to be $100.
So there you go.
We taking the train?
Sounds like a good deal.
Let's take the train. You want to take the train?
Yeah.
All right, listeners, if you're going to take the train, let us know, but we're going to officially train down to that. And then I just want to confirm again, the club is not doing anything to support this, so don't ask them to, like, where's the bus? Where's our ticket package? They're not doing that. Like, the Hartford one may probably be the only game of the year that they do that. So if you want to go down and be with the crazies, go down and be with the crazies. All right. I think we're done with news. I think we can. It's only been an hour.
Are you sure?
I think it's only been an hour. All right. Let's lightning fast this. Like, we got to lock in here, as the kids say. Well, it's official. Last week, we spoke on the leak shared by USL Championship rumors at the mentioning of the alleged signing of Aldair Sanchez, who was in free agency after contract renegotiations broke down with Sacramento Republic. The morning, of course, after release, it becomes official. The 22-year-old Vancouver Washington native became the fifth signing for the 2025 season. It's interesting. You know, we already talked about him, so if you want to hear about his potential with the team and where he'll fit in, we covered that last week. But I thought it was really interesting. I went back through some of his Sacramento Republic news. I didn't realize he was a tryout. He was a trialist that earned his spot. Like, I kind of thought like he was really good, and then like they poached him from the Timbers 2 Academy. No, he did a walk-on, and they were so impressed with him that they kept him for 2 years. And we saw the results. We saw the impact that he had on the Republic. You know, I guess the only thing I want to ask you here is, Sanchez a player we needed with Rivera being able to play on both wings? We'd kind of already identified Danny as a versatility player. We now have a wing back on each side. Do you think this was a statement to that, or was there a variation in the 3-5-2 potentially this season?
I mean, think about how many times, you know, we took off Quisera and Steven Turnbull because they were gassed, right? Like, they need some help in terms of rotation. And last season saw tons of fullbacks, or maybe, you know, Swiss Army knives like Clay just kind of fill in and take those spots. So it makes sense to have another quote unquote, like, at legit fullback for rotation purposes, especially, you know, with the potential there to be quite a few games this year. But obviously, I think the team just listened to the pod and was like, well, if they like him, maybe we should just sign him up.
I have no other words on it. I mean, I think he's going to be a depth piece. We kind of saw in the Orlando piece, we'll talk about that in a second, where he kind of shook up on it. I think this is going to be fantastic. And as long as he's content with the role that he's going to be asked to be played, this is the exact kind of signing that you want. Not to be outdone, but we do have to move on. We had another signing. We have another one after that to cover. You want to take it away with Cole Dewhurst?
Classic Ramstein song. So Rhode Island FC has signed defender Cole Dewhurst for the 2025 season, pending league and federation approval. The Lancaster Mass native becomes the 7th new signing of the 2025 season and 31st all-time acquisition for RAFC. Dewhurst is the 3rd player to join RAFC from Providence College, joining midfielder Kevin Vang and former defender Nathan Messer. It's always exciting to welcome local talent to the roster, said Rhode Island FC head coach and general manager Cono Smith. Providence College has an authentic soccer environment that sets the players up to play professionally. Cole developed greatly during his time there, and we look forward to helping him grow as a professional. Dewhurst was a regular contributor to the Friars during his 4-year collegiate career, starting 65 of 67 total appearances. He started all 39 games through his final 2 seasons, going the full 90 in all but 6 games during that span. In 2023, he was named to the All Big East third team after tallying a career-high 2 goals and 1 assist. In 2024, he logged 1,911 minutes as a crucial piece of the back line that conceded just 0.95 goals per game, which was the 4th lowest in the Big East. Prior to his time in Providence, Dewhurst played more than 90 games for the New England Revolution Academy. The defender worked his way up to the New England Revolution 2 lineup, making his professional debut with the MLS reserve team on April 10th, 2021 in USL League One play.
So what, Revs Academy, Revs 2, insert Revs 2 joke here. We're always going to be Revs Light, right?
I mean, now this makes sense. Why was
I... I mean, okay, we've talked at length about some of the other transactions that have occurred, and we've tried to make sure that we come from a place that this is not a like for like. You know, maybe there are profiles to the players, but you can't call Alder Sanchez Gabby Alves, right? You shouldn't do that. In this particular case, though, I feel like this is both literally and figuratively the Nate Messer replacement. One, I mean, the Providence College aspects of it. But two, you know, I look at he's a young defender who is looking for professional minutes, professional opportunities. I watched him a lot while he was a trialist because he was one of the few people we could identify at the first kind of open practice. And he did a lot of good things with it. You know, he wasn't afraid to get on the ball. He had some pretty good control. I will say he's tall. He's 6'2", but he's also very light. Like, he's very thin. And, I'm not saying that he could benefit. I'm not saying that he could benefit by putting on some mass, you know, getting a little bit more muscle.
Tell him to bulk up.
But, you know, also, I look at Frank Nadarse, and he is also thin for his height, and I think he just hides his bulk pretty well. This could be a case of it for what's going on with Cole. But like I looked at, I did see a couple times when he went with, you know, Khalifa or JJ, and like he was just getting bodied. So, you know, exciting to see what happens here. I think he's got a pretty high ceiling considering he hasn't really gotten the looks or the shake that he probably needs in one of the professional circuits. And let's also not forget that now Messer, he's playing with USL 1, right? So maybe this is like a step just a little beyond his current capabilities and he's going to grow into that. Or maybe he becomes the practice guy that helps the team grow and be better. And then maybe he finds his fortunes in a lesser league or an equidistant league in the future. I don't think this is a bad signing. And again, if we're gonna call like swap for swap, this is probably really good business done by the club.
Yeah, definitely.
Funny enough, Dewhurst's dad is Jason Dewhurst. He's the head coach. He's the director of coaching for the Youth Academy FC Stars. When I went to go pull the information, first thing I thought, just because we had been talking about the badge information, it's literally a crest with stars and soccer balls in it.
I'd say how dare they, but maybe I need to reassess my chest, as they say, and kind of create some sort of dissertation about what it is that I actually look for in badges, because I honestly had no idea that the Ascent had a ball. Their logo.
You just got distracted by the
sunset pretty colors
and the mountains. Yeah.
I was like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah, no, hun, I get it. And then let's move on to the final one. The final signing for now, we know who will occupy that third rotation in the goalkeeper core. Will Meyer officially signs with Rhode Island FC. I'll ask you in a second about a little bit of the tape on him, but while I was trying to do recon, I hate this. This is the worst part about getting old. I went to go do some research and I went on his Instagram, and he's young enough at 26 years old that he's basically lived his entire life posting his life on it. So you're able to go back on his Instagram to like when he was 13 years old. And
nice.
It's fun. It's fun seeing children grow up into men and then realize that you're old and you're on the wrong side of father time, so to speak. So that was great. You know, I miss the days where we could hide our like journeys in technology because they would fold and they would get absorbed every like 10 years. Like we had a MySpace era, we had a Facebook era.
Are you telling my Zonga is still not active?
I don't know, but I'm just saying, I couldn't find what I was when I was 13 years old. I don't remember who my top six or top eight was. But back on
probably
track,
Tom.
Back on track. What can you tell us about the 6'2" Solon, Ohio native?
So yeah, there's not a lot of footage from him in terms of his MLS Next Pro days, which, you know, just the way that MLS is, they are very protective, but there's tons of college footage of him. So, you know, I kind of stuck to the highlights. I didn't have that much free time, so I watched a collection of highlights of him, and you know, he seems pretty good. He's not afraid to come out and kind of make himself big and stop attacks. He, you know, can play that sweeper keeper role. He's got obviously these are highlights, so they're only showing the best parts, but he's got a decent distribution in him. Like he's not afraid to like try that pass over the top to break the lines and, you know, maybe hit it directly out to a winger to get past the center backs here and move the possession forward. He's very active in terms of his like positioning to make sure that he tries to set himself up in the right spot. Like he seems like he's doing all the right things, that maybe he just needs some more time to kind of hit like his peak. With goalkeepers, they kind of age like fine wine. Very rarely, unless they're a phenom, you know, are they ready to go right out the bat at 20 years old? So I think he's still, you know, maybe one for the future. When we look at his MLS Next Pro career, he only played 10 matches between the Red Bulls 2 and New York City FC 2, allowing 16 goals in that time, keeping two clean sheets, 1.6 goals allowed per game average. I mean, it's a small sample size, so it's kind of difficult to make, you know, sweeping takes on what he's going to be. The reality, and we've said this before, with a third goalkeeper there, he's for training purposes with the team, and kind of worst case scenario, if you find yourself in a position where one of the other two is injured, you just kind of need him to be ready and available to go.
Yeah, I'd be curious what the MLS Next Pro's like average PPG is and average number of goals scored in a game. Like, are those high scoring like events? I've never gotten close enough to MLS Next Pro to understand it. But you're spot on about like the needs of what Will Meyer is going to provide. You know, when we talked to Coach Spratty in the offseason, he intentionally went out of his way several times in the course of the interview to remind us that, you know, one, he'd be very deliberate in choosing the next keeper that would occupy that third rotation, but that also this wasn't a third keeper. This was someone that was going to be able to hold the other two men accountable in the core and compete with them. When we released the signing of this, there were some people asking about, you know, comparisons to Nate Silvera. And I don't think it's fair to even try because we saw so little of Nate as well. We'd have to go back to his time with the clubs that he was before. But I had explained, you know, like this is the perfect signing to a couple of people online because you need the third. You always need a third keeper in case of injury, rotation, or if like suddenly there was an interest to buy Jackson Lee, then what are you going to do? And I made the mistake. You should never assume someone has all of the working knowledge that you have because they immediately said, oh.
Wait, did we sell Jackson Lee?
Did we sell Jackson Lee? So I had to like walk that back and like Jackson Lee is happy where he is.
They're going
to
cut that sound bite. heard it here first.
But having said that, you know, there is also a reality where Jackson Lee, I wouldn't be surprised. Like we can't hold on to him forever. You can't have two top tier talented keepers of that nature in the team and then have them fight over the starting role. A USL club will come knocking for Jackson Lee or an MLS team will. I mean, LAFC's rights die in like 12 months. So
maybe Kaylor's Birmingham will have another 6 goalkeeper injuries.
Birmingham isn't allowed to have another RAFC player for 5 years. Kevin writes in, if he was a fan and not a new player, where would he park? He wanted to catch a game at Tidewater. Kevin, I will tell you right now, we're going to address parking in the Q&A. We're not going to talk about it here on the show, but I'm glad that you're still listening along. So those are the three signings that we have as of right now. But what if I told you, Jason, there was more? Before we go into that, I want to ask you, Rhode Island FC now has 23 players under contract for the 2025 season in the goalkeeper core. There's Jackson Lee, Koke Vegas, Will Meyer. Not Will Myers from the San Diego Padres, by the way. I saw that joke floating around earlier this week. In the defenders, we've got Ugo Bacharach. And remember, we're gonna get that right, fans. Frank Nodarce, Danny Rivera, Alder Sanchez, Grant Stoneman, Karifa Yao, and now Cole Dewhurst. In that midfield, we've got 10 midfielders. Isaac Anking, Joe Brito, Zachary Haravo, Clay Holstead, Jojea Quizera, Taimu Okiyoshi, Maxi Rodriguez, Amos Shapira-Thompson, Kevin Vang, and Mark Ibarra. And then up front, we've got our three forwards in Albert Dequa, Noah Fusan, and JJ Williams. Like I said, there may be another signing on the way. Jason, if we did have another signing, what would we need? Because on the screen, here are the 7 that we already have. And keep in mind, we lost 8 players at the exit of the 2024 season. 6 of them were regular players that moved on. 2 loanees that we didn't have. If we were to have one more, we'd technically have enough room for another one after that. What position do we need to fill?
At this point, I'd say the only position that we really need some kind of reinforcements or backup would be that striker core. Maybe another kind of goalkeeper situation where realistically we might see someone like Maxi pushed up before we get some depth there. But you can always find yourself in bad situations when it comes to injuries, and you just want to make sure that you're prepared. And even just in terms of, you know, maybe transactionally, just to have a player who you are kind of developing maybe to sell on to someone else at some point, you know, I think another forward would be beneficial.
So I heard a name get floated by, and again, this is why I don't say things until I can confirm it, but I heard a name and I got really excited because it was a Vermont Green alumni player. And I know you're thinking, like, you hear Vermont Green, you're like, oh, that's got to be Yaniv Bazzini. It's got to be Bazzini because everyone wants to know where Bazzini's going. And wouldn't that just be the cherry on top if Bazzini was playing for us? And if we're not, like, if he's not, like, why aren't we going after, like, where is Bazzini? Why is no one picking him up? But I will say, this is why you validate and you check, because I have learned that the name I got may not be the correct name. So while I have heard that there could be a potential Vermont Green alumni, I don't think it will be that. But I have heard that this person may, in fact, be a defender, which is interesting because I feel like we're good on defenders and we really are lacking in a forward at this point. To your point, I don't know. I mean, anything can happen, but I've heard that we may be on the cusp of signing one additional player, which would round us out to 7 of our 8 slots that we had rotated through last year. That doesn't mean we can't have more on the provisional roster. And I'm still on the holdout that Morris Dugan will occupy that eighth spot when he returns. And then we'll have, what, nine defenders at that point? So it all works out.
I mean, yeah, obviously Dugan is coming back.
Obviously. So that's it for now. We'll talk more as we get into the weeks ahead, as we get a look at the final kind of setup of this team. Let's quickly move on and talk about the Orlando game, because that's what everyone wanted to hear more about from earlier this week. On Tuesday, we were able to share the results from the second, you know, and I'm using air quotes here, official preseason game against Orlando City. This one took some work to source out because it was closed to the public as well as the press, but through some partnerships in the area, we were able to determine the Rhode Island FC. We were able to, excuse me, to determine that Rhode Island FC beat Orlando City 4-0 on the day.
Wow. Impressive. And it's kind of funny when we think about this, when last year Orlando beat us in that preseason, right? 3-1, I think it was, closed session, but Orlando City was kind of wrote an article about the results and
all the they leaked all the details.
Yeah. So at that point, when they win, of course, they're going to make a big deal out of it. You know, at this point, I haven't seen them say anything about this match. So
interesting how that worked. Maybe because there was nothing to write about with a 4-0 headline, right?
Yeah. When we think about this game, though, I mean, it's a preseason game at the end of the day, right? This is a good result. But like whether we win or lose, I think it's important that Kano kind of gets the chance to see what he's kind of constructing there, what kind of maybe goals he has for in terms of what players he maybe wants to try and challenge for certain positions, and just to kind of have the team play against competent competition so that it's not beating up on, you know, like a minnows.
Well, and so
benefit you in any way.
So we can talk about that to a certain extent, and that's because, you know, Orange County Soccer Club fans, or did I say Orange County? I'm in Orlando City. OCSC is too, it's too similar. But they complained online that, you know, how could they let a USL squad, even the USL Cup final runner-ups, you know, do this to their squad? And so they started sprinkling some copium amongst their ranks, saying like, oh, well, USL is just, they get lucky every once in a while. But then one of their, I don't know, fan accounts who claimed to be an insider was like, and they tried to minimize the impact of the RIFC results of this by saying like, oh, we only played Orange, here we go again. We only played Orlando City Soccer Club B. Like, we didn't play the first team, or we played the academy. So they started kind of trying to change the narrative there. I know for a fact that, yes, there were some B players on there, but there were also a lot of first team players. Now, I won't pretend to say that there's stars like Nicholas Ladero played 90 minutes and got, you know, just beat down. But let's not pretend that they didn't field a portion of their first teams as well, right? They're most likely, and this is what I don't know, but I could speculate from what I've learned that, like, okay, yeah, you didn't play all of the starting 11, but maybe you played two players from the starting 11 and all of the reserve side, and then you sprinkled in some B. And then in, like, when you rotate that in the 30-minute, the 45-minute mark, then it's more B. But this wasn't like Rhode Island FC beats down Orlando City Academy and runs away with the trophy. Like, that's not what happened here. So it's interesting. Like, again, results don't matter here because you're out there, like you said, to ascertain an objective, to accomplish personal and squad goals when it comes to how, like, you wanting to shake out. But let's also not pretend like they put out a lesser squad.
Well, speaking of squads, do we know who RFC played? Was it just Messi's son?
What was that, 12-0, whatever that was? So we don't have this confirmed, but we did, you know, the beauty of it is you get these photos afterwards, you can start piecing things together. There is some conclusions we can make from the photography that was taken on the field that day. It looks like they played a 3-5-2. Now, the interesting thing here, based on the pictures we saw of the squad forming up, you had Koke Vegas, you had Grant Stoneman, Karifa Yao, and Frank Nodarse, because remember, Ugo is still on the mend, so that back line was of the starting three center backs from last season minus Morris. And then here's where it gets interesting, because you don't see Chico in the picture. You see 10 of the 11 players, but if you look at Jorgea's back, you see a dark hand on his back, and it's not Jorgea holding himself in like an inverted, you know, my hands behind my back touching the lower back. It has to be someone with dark skin. And from the players that were on the bench and the players that were missing from the bench, the only person that could have been was Chico. So if that's Chico, then and if we played in a 3-5-2, the only way that could work out then was that Noah Fusson was put into that right wing back position Clay Holsted, Maxi Rodriguez, Mark Ibarra, and Jokes Quisera, along with Chico then and J.J. Williams up front. So the guess here is Chico because you can't see the 11th man. But if you look at, again, if you look at the hand, it has to be him. And then if you're going to try another formation, it doesn't really make sense because then it's Clay Holsted as a right wing back or a right back and you're playing like a 4-3-3. Who knows? We don't know. We're assuming the 3-5-2, but that would have been the starting 11. Interestingly, there was a lot of other players shown on the bench that I've never seen before. The Discord was trying to do capital J journalism. So I was kind of interested to see that. And then, so we know the field that we think may have been, or the team that may have been fielded, excuse me. We don't know the goals that got scored, but there is a photo of J.J. Williams high-fiving Karifa Yao. I mean, when you look at it, for Karifa to be that high up for a high five tells me it may have been a set piece and that he scored it. But also J.J. Williams could have just been walking back after scoring and meeting up with Karifa at like the midline. So one of the two of them was either involved or maybe both of them in a goal. But that is all the information that we can extract because the both clubs are very stingy about sharing this information.
I'm curious as we, you know, continue through the preseason here, what specifically coach will be looking for. We have assumptions that he's going to continue with the 3-5-2. Maybe a few tactical tweaks based upon the players that he has. But like, you know, what terms of positions are available for grab? Obviously, someone like Turnbull, who's gone. But I wonder if we're going to have up for any surprises when we make it to the first lineup of the season and we say, you know, I didn't see this coming.
I mean, you know, it's an interesting debate, right? Because again, 10 midfielders, if that's the deepest you are, you'd want it to be more than a 3 midfield line, right? You'd want like a 4-5-1, right? Yeah. Something. So that will be curious. I think really it's just going to be the right wing back spot. I think if you really chalk it up to, it could be Frank Nadarce, Danny Rivera, it could be another defender that may be getting signed, or it could be Noah Fusson. What an interesting way to have to be able to figure out if you're the opposing coach trying to plan for that, what an interesting challenge you have there. And like the versatility, again, like the I wouldn't even say dynamism, just the variety of choice you have on the day. Do you have someone more defensive or do you have a speedster? It'll all be really exciting at the end of the day.
Yeah, and to answer one of our chat questions here, yes, Nate, midfielders can be forwards. It is very much a tactic. You kind of have to build your play around it in a specific type of way, but that's definitely something that can happen, especially with someone like, for instance, Maxi Rodriguez, very talented goal scorer, you know, in his own right.
How many goals do you think Maxi Rodriguez is going to score in our system this year?
Ooh, I don't know.
All of them?
I think he'll, you know, maybe have something respectable like 8 goals and 8 assists or something like that.
Ryan writes in 700. I mean, to be fair to Ryan Healy from Tide Talk, I will say that I don't know another fan that is as high on Maxi Rodriguez as Ryan. I think Ryan already got Maxi Rodriguez tattooed on his body when he was still a Detroit City FC player. So to be completely fair to him, that tracks. All right, let's wrap things up here and let's get to Bermuda itself. So we're going to Bermuda. So the guys will be back this weekend, coming back from their time at IMG Academy. So the Florida trip is coming to a conclusion. They're going to spend a week back home in the cold. There will be a game, because you know they got to make it home for Valentine's Day, right? Or Valentine's Day weekend, I should say. They missed the Super Bowl with their family. They got to be there. When is Valentine's Day? Valentine's Day would be the day after Valentine's.
Be the change you want to see in the world, you know.
I love it. So they'll be back, and then we do know that they have a game scheduled on February 19th at an undisclosed time at an undisclosed location.
This clearly Inter Messi, right?
Against Hartford Athletic.
Do they have to play against his son?
Hartford Athletic doesn't have a son.
No,
I know you are. Just get off of the messy jokes. Interestingly enough, by the way, Hartford had to delay their game with the Revolution. So I'm curious.
Weather or?
Probably. If it was at Gillette or, you know, Rev's open areas, it was probably an issue. So I'll be curious how that affects the preseason schedule. I don't know when that game got rescheduled to. So they'll do that. And then from there, they'll be taking off on February 21st, heading to Bermuda to take advantage of the facilities that the Bermuda Federation has set up as they take on the Hearts of Pine on the 24th and then take on the Bermuda Select Team on the 27th. Both of those games will be open to the public. So if you've been looking for a vacation and a way to watch your favorite soccer team in New England, I can't think of a better set of destinations to put together. I'm talking to you, pool party. I know you guys are the ones that would go to this. So go enjoy some pink sand beach and some excellent Rhode Island FC soccer and get an early look at Portland Hearts of Pine at the same time. And then finally, they'll conclude their trip on March 8th when they get back. Closed door, closed facility. My guess is that that will be Revs 2 because at that point, all the other teams in the league will have started, including the MLS, so your options would be limited. But that looks like that's it. Hey, we didn't go very long. I don't know how, but we somehow managed to keep this under an hour 30. So, you know what? Job well done. I'm happy. Are you happy?
Yeah, real quick about back to the Bermuda. Did you see the recent news article that TF Green is going to start offering direct flights to Bermuda?
Conor Smith must be so happy that he can just go home whenever he wants. I mean, that I'd like to think Breeze did that because of Conor Smith.
So I thought it was Breeze, and I went back and checked the article. It didn't say
it's
which.
Breeze.
I think it's
Breeze. I know. I saw Conor Smith like the post. It's
Airlines.
Breeze.
Okay. Anyways, it's like a fly there direct Thursday and then fly back Sunday.
Yeah, that's Breeze all the way.
But of course, it doesn't start till May. So
that, exactly. That's because that's Breeze. Like trying to go home to see my family in Los Angeles. Like I can't go with them until April. And then I can go like Mondays or Wednesdays, but I can go for $39. So, you know, like sometimes
to make a weird vacation schedule.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have a job right now, so let's do that. Real fast before we do go, we are going to answer all of the questions. We got a lot of them. So if you have any additional questions, feel free to fire them in the chat room. We're going to record it right after and release it on Mondays. And of course, before Jason gives us our final read, you're always welcome to leave comments in the exit video, and we'll make sure that we add those into the stream. So, Jason, for all of the fun that we had tonight, let's call it.
All right, guys, make sure to check out our friends over at the Blazing Musket for all of your New England soccer coverage, including RAFC, and that's at theblazingmusket.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Threads, TikTok, and Blue Sky at RAFC Podcast. Instagram at Raising Anchor, and then we got that website, RaisingAnchorPodcast.com. Anchor's up, buddy.
Anchor's up, buddy. See you guys later.
Later.